Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish the book, reading the book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. A few bits of news from last time. I finished my trip down in, I was working on a cruise ship down in North Africa. I went to Morocco, Casablanca there, which was quite interesting. Not actually a very pleasant place to visit, to be honest. Two young men tried to steal my camera and my iPod and they're like, hey, give us your... But I managed to sort of get away from that with the help of some... friendly locals, but I did sort of know this a bit about Morocco because Polo, my ex-girlfriend, went there and she really, really didn't like it. And she was sort of, and she says, no, watch out, it's all like this. It's all like, it can't be that bad. But when I got there, it really was quite bad. But also, just the day before that, when I was actually just uploading, or as I went to upload the previous podcast, which was Steel Beach, my review of Steel Beach, someone had posted on Twitter, hey, the sfbrp.com is down, and I checked and it was, and I'd actually got an email about it but didn't realise it was they'd actually removed my website for it being hacked, so I had to spend about like 2 hours getting all that sorted. And it wasn't just my sfbrp.com, it was lukeandpolar.com and lukeburridge.com and all the websites that I have on my hosted server all went down. But I got it all back and got up and running again, which I was quite pleased that I managed to be able to do that with not much help. And I think that's about all the news. Oh, On impulse, I bought a ticket, a pass to TAM London, the amazing meeting in London this coming weekend. Probably the crossover of science fiction readers and sort of science fans slash sort of skeptical kind of people. Probably there's a little bit of a crossover there, but it's going to be great to go to a convention just as a punter. I'm not, because normally I go to juggling conventions and I perform and help organize stuff and things like that. So it's just going to be me consuming at this convention rather than creating and making and organizing. Anyway. That's all my news. I might talk about a little bit more about that on the next episode or whenever I put the next episode out. On to today's book review. I just finished reading Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. It was published in 1932, and it was around about, it was over 200 pages long, probably about 250 pages long. I left the book on the cruise ship because it was from the library there, so I don't have it in front of me, so I'm just going from memory and from the structure that I normally do this podcast in, and see if I can do it, and a few of the notes that I took at the same time. And while I'm at it, let me quickly open up Wikipedia, so I've got a list of the characters as well. Let me do that now. Wiki. So yes, why did I read this novel? Well, first of all, when I was on the cruise ship, previous cruise ship, I read Fahrenheit 451, and I was reading that because I thought, wow, this is good, and then I thought, well, I should read these sort of other classic dystopian sort of no books in the future kind of novels, and there's of course 1984 and Brave New World, which are sort of these, like, I guess they're often clumped together as a group of three, especially Brave New World and 1984. I guess Fahrenheit 451 less so, but they do sort of have common themes and stuff. So I thought I'll do these books and I'll read them all and review them all. I've read 1984 many times, I've read Fahrenheit 451 many times, and this is actually the second time I've read Brave New World. Another reason why I thought, you know, I was reminded to read this book was the book that I reviewed in the last episode, Steel Beach by John Varley. I think there's quite a few parallels that could be drawn between these two novels. Yes, and also one other thing that I just made a note here, that when I mentioned Steel Beach, I forgot to mention in last week's podcast that I've actually read a John Varley book before, which was called Red Thunder, and it was pretty much one of the worst books that I read last year that I actually completed reading, actually finished reading, and I don't think I had very much good to say about the novel, but I always do give a novel author a second chance at a second novel, and I'm glad I did actually, because there's a few novels that I've read which I was like, not quite so sure, and then I read a second novel by that same author and really, really enjoy it. It's happened a few times in this podcast reviewing kind of journey that I'm taking, but mainly because people say, oh well, don't bother with that book, but check out this book by the same author, and I'm like, oh okay, no problem at all. So, and another thing is, I mentioned as well in my sort of related titles, I sort of like, if you like this book, you may also like this. And I said, I couldn't think of another novel very much about suicide or the reasons of suicide or dealing with suicide as the same theme at the time. But of course, thinking about it a bit more, I remember Look to Windward by Ian M. Banks. And that has got a lot of things in common with Steel Beach by John Varley, especially that they've got the essential computer who is also feeling a little bit suicidal at the same time. So definitely check out Look to Windward. I think it is probably a little bit better than Steel Beach, but you know they're very similar books and quite similar styles of books in many ways. So where was I saying? Oh yes, Fahrenheit 451 led on to Brave New World with ties into other things that I'm not going to linger on. I'm just going to dive straight into this. First of all, starting off with the world of Brave New World. What is the sort of like setup here? Well, first of all, it's mainly about. I'll do this way. Okay. I'm confused where to start with this, because if I had the book in front of me, I'd just turn to the first page. Okay, I'll do it that way. This is the life cycle of a human in the Brave New World. You start off and you have this process where they split an egg and the sperm and sort of into identical twins, but they don't just get a pair of identical twins like me and my brother, identical twins. They have many more identical twins, up to 96 or something identical twins, or 96 tuplets or whatever you'd call them, and so they're set off in a big batch and they go along this you're going along this conveyor belt and you're nurtured or you're stunted into five different castes, and you get alphas and betas and gammas and deltas and epsilons, and of course alphas run everything, and all alphas, they're not identical twins, and I don't think betas are either, or the betas are, they are just individual eggs, whereas anything below that, the gammas through to epsilons, they come out in these big batches. And then they're decanted, and then they're conditioned in their sleep. So the alphas are all sort of like conditioned to be leaders, and like in a sort of like this hypnotic suggestions in people's sleep. And of course, the epsilons and the gammas and the deltas, they're all conditioned to be happy just to serve the alphas and the betas and to keep everything moving. But they're not just conditioned to do that, they're just conditioned to be happy and conditioned to consume and conditioned to enjoy sex and singing and want to do sport and everything like that. And generally, people are put to work and they're happy with their life. Everyone is happy because they can play sports and they can buy things and they can go and see shows and they can sing and have sex and everything like that. So everyone's really happy. And if you're not quite happy enough, there's a drug called Soma that you can take, and it makes you really happy. But you're not allowed to read, or there is no reading going on or anything like that. You can watch TV or listen to the radio or go to the Feelies, which is some kind of like a play on, you know, the movies and the talkies, and then it's the Feelies and the smell kind of things that they do there, have this smelling sense thing. And then at the end of the life, you're really healthy until the very end of your life, because you've been conditioned and sort of genetically selected for to be very healthy. And then when you get to about age 60, your body just collapses and you die. But nobody really worries about dying or anything like that. It's everyone just accepts it. Then at the end of your life, you are recycled and they get your potassium from you and things like that. And actually, it's a really, really good bit of world building, because it's not often that you'll, right at the very beginning of a book, you'll find out pretty much about the entire life cycle of someone, and that is where the book starts. It really falls down, though, because it's sort of like, it's not a serious prediction about where the future is heading. It's more of a satire on the classes, class system at the time, and, you know, when it was written back in the early 1930s, and also, a lot of it is sort of backed up by this. It's quite a light tone to the novel, even though it could be seen as like a serious subject. There's a very sort of like joke when he talks about these ideas. It's a lot of jokes about it, and that didn't really sit right. Although the actual world, I think, is a very well realized world, and that's the thing that people always, you know, when they refer back to this book, they always talk about the world. Very few people talk about the story of the Brave New World. Everyone just talks about, you know, the Soma and the sex and the conditioning and things like that. Another big clash with me is the idea of mass production and massive consumption. It's mentioned in the book that everyone has to consume, and the sports that they have, they say, well, we're not going to have any normal sports where you can just buy one ball and kick it about. You have to have a sport where it takes up energy and it takes up product and things like that. So you have to keep consuming it. The thing is, in the book, you actually realize that that whole part of the book doesn't really play into anything to do with the themes, or very much to do with the themes, and nothing to do with the story has anything to do with them consuming stuff. Like, every time they talk about one of the sports that they play, it could just as easily have been normal golf rather than obstacle golf, or it could have just been normal tennis rather than whatever the mechanical tennis courts that they used for, you know, playing their own version of tennis in the Brave New World was. And it's because it seems like nobody really enjoys the consumption-based activities more than the non-consumption-based activities. So sport and sex and travel and eating soma, they're equally enjoyed, but, you know, the actual consumption behind it isn't actually that vital to the book at all. And yet so much of the world is based on that, because they reset the clock to the beginning of the era of the Ford Model T car, which is the first production line factory kind of thing. So they say, okay, that's really the beginning of our consumer age, but then so much of it isn't there, you know, and Ford himself is like this religious, almost like a religious ancestor figure, and everyone swears by Ford, and, you know, instead of the sign of the cross, people put the sign of the T on them. And again, it's in there, and it adds to it in a bit, but it didn't really sort of add a lot to it in anything else except a little bit of flavour there. But so much of the book is spent on that, but it's not really discussed. A lot of people talk about this book as like, oh, it's a great example of prediction, and there's this, and of course there's, like I say, there's Fahrenheit 451 and 1984. I don't want to get into those books now, but everyone says, oh, you know, is the world becoming more like the Brave New World? And lots of people say, yes, it is. And I, you know, obviously read these things, and I saw this little cartoon that someone made the other day. You know, I read it the other day, but somebody made it, obviously within the last few years, talking about, you know, how much, you know, the Brave New World is predicting the future. And in some ways, it does actually talk about some things that have come true. You know, some people do spend too much time in front of the TV, and a lot of people take drugs, and a lot of people don't bother learning how to read, or maybe they're not so much they don't bother, but, you know, there's literacy rates in some places isn't that high, and consumerism is very high. But there's like loads of big points that this book really misses. And even though people say that these other things, like the consumerism, is like what the book is about, I don't think so. And again, you can't just sort of make some predictions, or you can't just look at, you know, the world and then draw a target, or, you know, throw an arrow into a world and then draw a target around where you've already thrown the arrow and say, look, it all fits, because there's so much that doesn't fit. There is, you know, aside from everybody playing sport and everyone being happy, which isn't, you know, not everybody is happy. People try and make people happy, but, you know, everyone isn't happy in the world today, and not everybody is on drugs, and the drugs that they are on aren't the perfect soma kind of drugs. The thing is, the caste system, like the pre-selected caste system, while if you're born into one kind of, like, if you're born into like a middle class background, you're probably more likely to go to university, and if you're born into like a working class kind of background, you're probably not going to go to university and do that kind of stuff. But that is not institutionalized in the same way that is in the book. And the main thing is the conditioning the children. Literally every child is conditioned from birth. And that, well, no, even from before birth. And while that does happen a bit, you know, like when you're young, you know, especially me, my father was disabled, and I never went out and played football with him, and we weren't interested in football. But yet, like, everybody at school was almost conditioned to be a fan of football and have sort of like that footballer kind of tribal mentality. And everybody as a child had a television. And when I was growing up, we never had a television in the house. So again, like, everybody were talking about television. This happened on television, and there was Neighbours last night, and Home and Away did this, and Coronation Street. And I never really had any of that. So I can see that there is some kind of conditioning from birth, but it's not like it's not institutionalized in a way that there you can't function in the world without this conditioning. Whereas in Brave New World, it would be impossible to function in the world unless you did have that conditioning. For example, I don't like beer, and I don't believe anybody who has ever tasted beer really liked beer the first time they taste it, because everyone tastes beer for the first time and just goes, ugh, that tastes disgusting. And it's the same with so many other things, but, you know, you're conditioned that, oh no, beer is good for you, you should be drinking beer if you're a manly kind of guy. If you're from the UK and you don't drink beer, your sexuality is being questioned and things, just because you don't like the sort of beer taste. And I really don't like beer, and I never have done, but people get conditioned to it in a way. But it's not the same at, like, institutionalized kind of you know, thing that's in is in Brave New World, which the Brave New World universe or world itself actually relies on 100% to function in the first place. So if the one thing, like, it doesn't rely 100% on consumerism, it doesn't rely 100% on the drugs or, you know, on these other things, but it does rely 100% on the conditioning. And that isn't here, and it never will be here, like sleep, you know, conditioning for children. And the other thing is that there's no families and there's no meaningful relationships between people. And if there's one thing that, you know, that families are sort of being less and less important in a way, you know, people don't have like the strong family unit anymore. And people are going, oh, the breakdown of the family is really, really bad. But people still have relationships with brothers and sisters, and they still have relationships with, you know, mothers and some fathers, you know, in that way. So even if the family unit breaks down, you still have meaningful relationships with other people that you're related to, or even friends, or even husbands and wives, and it's still there. And in the Brave New World, that is one of those things that the book, the world relies on the whole no families thing, and the book relies on the massive sort of like, you know, multiple... multiple children in the same sort of genetically identical group coming off the production line, literally off the production line in this book, and that's not there. So I don't think it's a great sort of like prediction of the future, although you can use it to comment on the world today. I think that it's almost more of a comment on what Aldous Huxley thought the future was going to be, or what Aldous Huxley thought the world at the time was, rather than actually the future. Anyway, I've gone on maybe way too long just about the world of the book, so I'm going to skip forward now onto the story of the book. I remember reading this book years and years ago, probably when about, probably when I was at school I read this book for the first time. It would have been in the school library, and because I spent a lot of time in the school library, and I read most of the kind of books of this kind in the school library for the first time. Again, I remember when they just released, they're releasing Google Wave at the moment. And for me, The Wave is the book, The Wave, which is sort of like the whole fascism in the classroom kind of thing. And of course, I read that at school in that kind of section of political books for young people. And of course, Brave New World was there, even though I don't really think it's just for young people, although I guess it is one of those required reading books at school. But I remember the story being a lot better than it was now. But, you know, it's sort of really quite... like rambling and meandering and doesn't actually have a very good focus anywhere in the book at all. We start off with the director of the birthing institute, and he's showing some kids around the, you know, where people come from, the kind of sort of you know, it's, you know, the eggs go in here and then they get decanted there, you know, that kind of thing. But he meets Foster, the director meets someone called Foster, and then we follow Foster for a little bit, and then, you know, Foster's explaining, and then he meets Lenina, who's his sort of like a girlfriend, but, you know, everyone is for everyone else, and everyone can love and have sex with anyone else that they want to. So meets Lenina, and then Lenina goes off and meets someone else, a friend, and then talks to a friend about Bernard, and then we're with Bernard a little bit, and Bernard goes off and he talks to a friend called Helmholtz, and then Mustafa comes in, who is like, he's like the director of Western Europe. He's the controller of Western Europe, and he sort of appears for not very much reason there at the beginning of the book, although he has a bit of a chat. And then these other people, they go off and talk to this person and then that person. And you understand, like, the person that we started off with the book, which is the director, he sort of drops out for ages. And then Foster is there, but then he drops out. But anyway, the plot plots on for a plodding bit. Getting my words mixed up there. Anyway, then Bernard says to Lenina, hey, do you want to fly out to Arizona to visit the Savage Reservation? So they do, and they fly out there. But oh, wait a second, they have a discussion with the director. And he says, oh, I was there before, and I went off with a girlfriend as well, but I left her behind and didn't bring her back, and it was a bit of a, you know, a bit of a tragedy there. So anyway, as Bernard and Lenina fly out, they meet Linda, the old girl of the director, and her son called John, who is then known as John the Savage, or just John Savage. We get a bit of John's backstory, and then they go back to London, and you have sort of a bit of a fish out of water kind of stuff with John Savage back in London. But and then of course John Savage does meet up with Mustafa, the director of Western Europe, and, you know, some things happen, and then blah blah blah, the end. And that's the whole story. Again, it's the book isn't about the story. Even if you know the story, that's not really what the book is about, because, as I said before, the entire thing is a satire. So the story is less important than the ideas that Aldous Huxley wants to lampoon or talk about in the first place. And there's massive flaws in this plot, you know, that can only be resolved through the utter stupidity of the characters involved. And unlike the movie, or very much like the movie Idiocracy, if a world can't function if everybody is that stupid. Like, if they, you know, the thing that happens that moves the plots forward time and time again is just someone is really, really stupid. But if that's the sort of standard for the world, the world couldn't exist in a way, you know. So it's a very strange thing there. Also, the story, like I said before, never really focuses on any one person long enough for me to start caring about them. You actually think, who is the protagonist in this novel? And it starts off and you think, well, it's the director. No, it's not. Oh, it'll be this guy called Thomas Foster. And it's like, no, not him either. And then you're going on, and then it's Bernard's story for quite a long time, but not really. But then the focus eventually falls on John Savage. But he doesn't turn up for the book until like over halfway through. And in the end, it's just not that interesting, because you can't, it's like I'm not allowed to care for any of these people, which is really strange. And the whole fish out of water thing with John Savage coming back to London is useless, because he's been told all about what London is like by his mother, who's been there before. And when he gets back, he's like, oh, yeah, my mother told me about this. I don't really care about it. Oh, what about this? You know, helicopters. Oh, I don't really care. You know, my mother told me about that. What about this? Oh, yeah, my mother told me all about this. So there's not even the really interesting fish out of water stuff. And also, when Bernard and Lenina go off to the Savages, there's not even that kind of fish out of water. They're like, oh, how are these people going to survive? The story that I'd really like to have read is the story of the director in the first place, you know, this, him going off to the Savage Reservation and losing Linda there. That would have been a little bit more interesting. So I don't really care about those people involved. And that brings me really being someone to the characters, because all of the characters are really flat. They're just caricatures for, like, this person is this character, this person is this character, this person is this character, and none of them really go on any kind of, like, personal journey. You know, they're all... Every one of them is exactly the same person at the end of the book as they are at the beginning of the book, even though when there's some of them, they sort of slightly change, like John Savage, he changes, but then he sort of changes back again. And just, I mean, he does have a bit more of a story than the other people, but like I say, he's only in there from half of the way along, and you don't actually like him at all. Bernard, he changes in a way, he's like a more interesting character, but then after he changes back, and his relationship with Helmholtz just clicks back into what it was at the beginning of the book, so that's a bit strange as well. So it's like, is there any point to any of these characters except that, hey, these are the characters and this is what they're all going to be like? And I'm thinking, maybe it's intentional. Everyone in the future is just going to have this single role and not deviate, and they're all just going to have like a single aspect to their personality. And if it's intentional, it means it's not a very good book, because that doesn't make for an interesting book. And if it isn't intentional, it's just bad writing, and he should have spent more time on the characters to actually make me care about at least one of them. And even if he didn't want to spend more time writing the characters, maybe he could have, or developing the characters, maybe if he'd have just spent more time actually within the book focusing on one character's story, I'd have at least, you know, cared for them just out of, you know, some kind of... I've spent a lot of time with this person. I want to find out what the story is. But it jumps around the character so much that I didn't ever really care about any of them. Or it really, really suffered for that. Another thing is the whole kind of sex thing. Not sex, the gender thing. You know, all of the important characters are males, and none of the female characters have any kind of oomph behind them at all. They're all these, like, wet, dopey women who are just passive, like, weak-willed sex objects, that's it. And again, it might be the social engineering of the future, but all of the other social engineering is commented on in some way by Aldous Huxley, by the author. Even if it's not commented on about by the actual characters themselves, it's sort of written in a way to say, oh, and this is it's going to be different like this in the future, or this is going to be the same in the future, and this is where that comes from. You know, and there's lots of different ways he comments on all these other aspects, except for the, like, massive gender disparity. And maybe in 1932 it was like such a misogynistic kind of time that it was natural to assume that in the future women would become even less significant than it was back in the 1930s. But again, I'm not sure. And it's a similar kind of thing with race, but race less so. At least it sort of comments on the racism, the blatant racism in the book. So I'm thinking, okay, that might not be Aldous Huxley's racism. I do know that the Huxleys, some of them were involved in a bit of eugenics kind of... advocacy in some ways. I don't know if Aldous Huxley was. I'll have to. There was an afterwards in the back of the book, but I can't remember if it said he was or he wasn't. But yeah, it was a bit strange in those ways. Moving on to the, what's the next tag that I do here? Science and technology and science fiction aspects. I think I talk quite a lot about that at the beginning of the book, in the way the world is set up, because that's what it all is. One thing I did make a note of here is that it reflects the fears of the times. For example, there's the whole sort of overpopulation fear of the 1930s. And the belt that they, like the chastity belts, the that they wear. Well, it's not even so much a chastity belt. It's more of like a contraceptive kind of pack. So it's not a chastity belt. It's the belt that they carry their contraceptives in. It's called the Malthusian belt or the Malthus belt. So that's quite funny. And also there's the whole gas, which I realize now is a real big fear in the 1930s, because in the Last and First Men, it came up a lot that the big sort of like weapon of mass destruction, the thing that was going to end the world, was the gas. And again, it's the same in this book. It's sort of like the gas attacks of dropping gas from aeroplanes. And this actually came up, it made me remember the World War series by Harry Turtledove, which is the alternative reality, not alternative reality, alternative history book, where the aliens arrive in 1940 or 1941, and at one point in the book, I think it's book 3 or 4 or something like that, and the aliens are doing quite well, and Churchill says, well, if you keep pushing, we'll use something that nobody has used yet so far in this war. And the aliens are like, yeah, bring it on, and they bring out the mustard gas, and the aliens are like, no, stop, can't deal with it. So it's that same kind of thing, that the gassing wasn't a big thing that was used in World War II, because I guess it was one of those things that was sort of like almost agreed on between the sides, that they weren't going to like repeat the gas attacks on the, like that they did in the trenches in the First World War, which of course Hitler was a big sort of like advocate against. Well, it was quite ironic that he was a victim of the gas attacks in the First World War, considering his role in the Holocaust of the Jews there. But of course that is a big thing in this book as well, and in Last and First Men. And probably if I go back and read some more 1930s science fiction, I could probably find more examples of this. And of course, as soon as the Second World War is over, the big sort of thing is the atomic bomb and the atomic age, and that's then the big fear. And I think gas and the sort of the use of gas, or the future use of gas, drops out of science fiction completely. Maybe there's some kind of thesis for some literary students to write there about gas in science fiction. Maybe, I don't know. Anyway, onto the writing style. The writing style is actually quite variable. It starts off quite interesting, but it does get quite tedious and annoying in places. And then in other places, there's like these glimpses of genius and really funny humor. For example, one funny thing, which it didn't have anything to do with the plot, it's like Bernard, he goes off and he's trying to get into the Savage Reservation, and he's talking to the warden there, and suddenly he goes, oh, I left a tap on at home, and it wasn't a water tap, it was a cologne tap, so it was perfume tap, and that's really expensive. And he's like, oh no. And then he's just thinking, and while the warden is explaining the size of the park and the history of the park and what the park is for, which otherwise would just be like this like info dump and sort of big exposition kind of piece, but just because we suddenly go, oh, Bernard left the tap on at home, and he has to call up his friend to go round to his house and turn the tap off at home, it suddenly makes that like bearable. And that was exactly the same point that I brought up with Fahrenheit 451, which I got off a blog called it was the Mystery Man on Film blog who was reviewing the scripting thing, and it was just that bringing in that sort of like in the sort of backstory, filling in info dump kind of thing, if you introduce some kind of tension into the book at that point, into the storyline at that point, we'll put up with it and just go with the big info dump, as long as there's something else going on there. And of course in Fahrenheit 451, that was the was when, what was his name, the police chief Beatty is talking to Guy, and Guy is hiding a book under his pillow, and his wife is trying to plump up the pillow. And so it is just sort of like backstory that's being explained there, but because of this sort of like Beatty might find Guy Montag with a book under his cover kind of like tension in the room as well, at the same time with his wife trying to not to discover it at the same time too, it makes it bearable, and that's what happens here. But in other points, he doesn't do that, and that point that he did do was almost like a blatant example of this. So even though it's really clever and funny, it just doesn't go anywhere. Like the whole tap left on at home, I thought, wow, this is going to have a ramification later on in the book, but it isn't. It's just dropped. And so many of these other parts are just dropped. And there's a bit near the start where he goes all kind of like, not so much non-linear, but he goes all roving, and you get like a paragraph here and then a paragraph at this other scene, and he swaps between three scenes continuously until he gets only like partial sentences from each scene. So this person did this, this person did this, this person said that, that person did this, this person said that, and that person did this. But all of these three sets of three or four pieces are happening in different places at the same time, so we're getting the book, and it was just a bit sort of like, yeah that's clever, but isn't it? No, it's not really that clever. And it didn't actually add anything, because then it was there and then no. Where else in the book did that come on? So he's just doing like a sort of like a postmodern kind of, or sort of like a modernist kind of literary experiment at the beginning of the book, and then just drops it. And but maybe that was a satire on the kind of writing style of the time that people were putting out in the 1930s. But then I'm thinking, well, if it is just a satire, it doesn't actually add anything to the book. So if it's not adding anything to the book in terms of, like, you know, of the character and the plot and the interest, it's just taking away, which is strange. And also there's the whole Shakespeare kind of thing, because John Savage, I didn't mention this before, but he learned to read, first of all, from some manual that his mother had, and then he gets given the complete works of Shakespeare. And then it's sort of like, we're just hammered home. It's like, yes, and he knows Shakespeare. And guess what? Aldous Huxley knows Shakespeare as well. And the whole sort of, like, Savage kind of thing going on, oh, isn't that a little bit like The Tempest? Yes, it is like The Tempest. Let's quote The Tempest all the way through, and let's name the book after The Tempest, and let him sort of, like, do the whole, what a brave new world that has such creatures in it, kind of thing, all that kind of thing. It's just over and over again, and I did get a little bit sick of all like the Shakespeare references, although this does actually tie in a bit to the story at the end, because John Savage's story does end like so many of Shakespeare's plays end, especially his tragedies. I don't want to give it too much away, but maybe some of the characters don't survive until the very end of the book. But then that whole kind of section, that whole kind of like way of looking at it, and this kind of grim ending to the book, and that is like, because it's done in such a satirical light tone, that's all undermined as well. Like, constantly we get this book that Ford is like, they instead of saying oh god, they say oh lord, or good lord, they say good Ford, and good Ford this, and over Ford's dead body. No, they don't actually say that, but it's that kind of thing, that's Ford this and Ford that. And it was like funny once, but then it's like all the way through the book, and yet it doesn't add anything. It's just there, and it just gets in the way. Every time they mention Ford, I'm like, okay, I disbelieve this world a little bit each time someone mentions that. Anyway, so writing style is sometimes good, sometimes not so good, variable throughout the book, let me put it this way. The themes of the book, I think one of the main themes of the book that Aldous Huxley really wants to bring out is like, look out, the future, the future's coming, it's going to be different in the future, and it's going to be bad in the future, like that. And it's just like, yeah, get over it and stuff. And it's like, and there's this whole other theme, it's like, what makes life worth with it? Let me try that, say, what makes life worth living kind of theme going on as well, which is that it sort of ties back into the Steel Beach. And in Steel Beach, I wasn't quite sure of the real message at the end of the book, and it's like, okay, is, you know, and actually in that book they say you've got to have the freedom to fail, and in this book it's sort of like you've got to have freedom to be unhappy and to be unhealthy and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, that's nice, and you have like the whole noble savage kind of going on, the savage who knows Shakespeare, but then it's sort of like, okay, if he's saying like we should all read Shakespeare, and I'm like, yeah, that's great, so we should all just like old stuff, really, is that it? And it's sort of like, is appreciating literature really all there is to life? And then he's going, oh, drugs are bad, and then it's like, and then he's like, but no, they're good, and no, but they're bad, and because they can take away sort of like the peak experiences, but it can, you know, drugs can also give like the peak experiences at the same time. So it's this strange thing, and like loads of people in the book rely on Soma, the drug, to get through the day, but lots of them don't, and lots of people just, you know, they take Soma when they need it, and other times they're not. And you know, and there's this, and that there's the other theme, it's sort of like, be careful of the abuse of science and the and brainwashing, be careful of brainwashing, and you're just like, of course be careful of that. It's like, oh, be careful of overconsumption, and you're like, yeah, of course. It's like, but it doesn't preach, it doesn't talk about like moderation. In the end, it only says it can be all of one thing, it can be all this, like all of the things that I'm saying are bad in the book, or it can be savagery, you know, and just living out in the middle of nowhere and whipping yourself when you feel bad and not having sex and you know, and living the life of a hermit. But then it doesn't say that, because then they've got this really cool get out of jail free clause in his world. It's like, oh, if you don't fit in, just go and live in Iceland or down on the Falklands. We got whole places out there for people who just don't fit in. They can go and live on their own island. And you're like, oh, well, that's a bit of an easy way out. You know, you're saying, so this is bad. Oh, no, it's good. Oh, no, but this is good. Oh, no, but it's bad. So in the end, we get like this exchange between Mustafa Mond, who is the director or dictator of Western Europe, and he knows that he's the dictator. And he's a bit like in the same way that BD is in Fahrenheit 451. He's like restricting and he's burning books, but yet he's very well read. He knows the books that he's burning. And Mustafa Mond is exactly, well, not exactly the same kind of character. He's a lot more powerful, and he doesn't have the whole kind of suicidal tendencies kind of going on there. But he's like this benevolent dictator, and he's like, no, really, it's good, and I know science is a lot better than it is, but you know, I'm restricting science for good, and I'm doing this for good, and everything's for good. And while I don't think Huxley himself agrees with very much that Mustafa Mond says, and he probably doesn't agree with all that, you know, John Savage says or these other characters says, I think Huxley probably identifies most with Mustafa Mond, because he's given like some of the best lines and he's given some of the best arguments, even if he doesn't agree with it, you know, if Huxley doesn't agree with the arguments. But it's that kind of like, listen to me and do as I say and everything will be fine. Just imagine if Aldous Huxley was this benevolent dictator and I would put the world to right, and everything should listen to me, and everyone who disagrees with me should just go live in Iceland or in the Falklands, and if you don't listen, if you don't agree with what I'm saying, well, you're much like an Epsilon or a Delta or something like that. And it's sort of like this so much the preachy kind of thing that's going on there, that it's like Aldous Huxley obviously does believe that he does have the answers, and that his view that he's writing in this book is either profound or a prediction or something like that. And I know it is, because it says at the end of the book, in the afterwards of the book, that he wrote another book called Brave New World Revisited, where he concludes that the world is actually going towards his prediction. And I'm like, well, maybe in the 70s you thought the world was going in that way, but it really isn't. The world really isn't going anywhere close to where Aldous Huxley thought. So we've got this great bit of like polemics and satire here from the 1930s, and it is worth reading it for that, you know, of a sort of like a 1930s view of the future, and I do think it's worth a read. But it doesn't, and it does have stuff to say about today's world, but it doesn't stand up even anywhere close to Fahrenheit 451, which I really enjoyed that. And I looked up what rating I gave it 3.5 stars, and compared to this book, that's like a 5-star book. And this book is probably, I'd give it around about 2 stars, because like the world is good, but it's undermined, as I said, by these flat characters and this disappointing plot, and it's got this flippant tone as well, as I said, and the whole overbearing kind of social and political commentary. But it is a book that you really might as well read. It doesn't take long to read, and it is one of these classics. And unlike a lot of these books that everyone should read, I think this is a book that you probably should read, just to see like where science fiction has come and how much it can sort of get into the world. You know, everyone knows 1984 and Big Brother. You know, Big Brother is like one of the biggest sort of like cultural icons in the world, even to this day. And Fahrenheit 451 is similar, and Brave New World, I'm not sure if it has that same status, but probably at one point it did have a similar kind of status, even though I don't think people concentrate on it so much now as they do to some of these other science fiction books. So definitely give it a read, but I'm only going to give it 2 stars, because this time out, it's based purely on my personal enjoyment, and I didn't enjoy it all that much. So the section here, if you liked this book, or if you've read this book and you want something similar, one cool thing is, which this book made me remember, is Pandora's Star and the Commonwealth series by Peter F. Hamilton. I've not reviewed those, but I have mentioned them before, because the Commonwealth story sort of continues in the Dreaming Void and the Temporal Void. And one of the main characters, her name is Paula Mayo, and she is like this genetically selected for, conditioned from birth to become a police detective, and she can do nothing but solve crimes. And she's from a world called Huxley's Haven, and in Huxley's Haven everyone is happy, but everyone is pure, and everyone is, you know, tailored to their job, and everyone else hates Huxley's Haven, and they're like, no, we can't allow this, we can't allow that. But everyone there is like really happy with life, and they're like, no, Huxley's Haven is fine, we're all getting on well here, you know. And it's this strange kind of optimistic view on the idea of Huxley's Haven. Although I must say that while these people in Brave New World are selected for genetically. There's no such, there isn't any genetic manipulation. It's all conditioning. Whereas in Huxley's Haven and Pandora's Star, Paula is abducted or kidnapped at a very young age, probably before any conditioning could have taken place. If I remember rightly, that's more of a sort of like a genetically kind of pure, genetically manipulated setup for people rather than a Brave New World is, which is all about conditioning. I guess you could go and see a production of The Tempest, or read Steel Beach, or check out Fahrenheit 451, which is, I think, far superior, and 1984, which is, I think, the best of the three books. But I don't want to comment much on it here because I want to read it again. Because I think in Fahrenheit 451, I said Brave New World was a better book than that. But now reading it again, I don't think it is. I think Fahrenheit 451 is better. The next book that I'm going to read is, well, actually, I started reading because when I finished this book, I had a plane journey home. So I got out my iPhone now, and started reading Post Singularity by Rudy Rucker. And the opening chapter was probably, and I'm not kidding here, probably one of the worst opening chapters to any book that I've ever read. And then I read the next chapter, and it didn't get any better. If anything, it got worse and more stupid and more pointless. So I'm not going to read Post Singularity by Rudy Rucker because it's literally not worth me pushing through past chapter 2, because then I started reading chapter 3 and it was still no, I read the prologue in chapter 1, and then as I was reading chapter 2, I think this is not worth any of my time at all. I can't remember who recommended Post Singularity to me, but I just can't put up with that at all. So I started reading, I picked up Eiffelheim again. I'm about 150 pages into that, so I probably finished that by the end of the week. And after that, I don't know, because I'm going away for the weekend. And then before the end of the year, I just counted up, I have 14 days left at home before the end of the year. So I'm probably going to be, you know, because I'm traveling so much, I'll be buying books along the way. So I don't have any clue what I'm going to read. Except really, if anyone has got any good books that I can read on my iPod or any good recommendations, please send them in to me of any free ebooks that you see out there and you recommend. I do have quite a few on there. I'm looking at Neptune Crossing. Can't remember the author of it. I started reading that on the way home on the plane, but there was a bit of a mix-up. One of the chapters was repeated twice, so I'm going to go back and see if I can find a file where I definitely know that I'm getting all of the chapters before I keep reading that. So that's it. So keep sending in your book suggestions, which are really great. That's how I read most of these books, is by your suggestions, or select a lot of these books is by your suggestions. Otherwise, email me, luke@juggler.net. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge on Twitter, or /Luke Burridge on Twitter. Same as goodreads.com. I'm moving all of my stuff over onto, well, not all of my stuff, but all book recommendations. Or if you want to see which books I've got recommendations for, or which books are in my queue to read, please go to goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. And I've got lots of shelves, so you can see which books I've reviewed already, which books have been recommended by who, which books I've got at home right now, which books I probably won't read again, or because I've read them already, and things like that. Otherwise, you can follow all my stuff on my blog, which is lukeburridge.com/blog, and any other information there. So that's about it. I hope you enjoyed this review. I've really enjoyed discussing this classic, Brave New World. And so I'll see you next time.